Hello and welcome to the latest edition of The Last Call with Two Boozy Hacks. My name's John Sweeney. Normally I'm in London, but today I'm in Italia, Fantastico. In New York is Mike Weiss, and today we're going to talk about all things Russia. We've got a fantastic, two fantastic guests. Catherine Belton, the author of the smash hit Putin's People, and Luke Harding, the author of the smash hit I've Got to Be Equal, Shadow State. Both know their Russia, both know their snow on the boots, so it's going to be a really interesting dissection of how Russia seems to be winning the post-Cold War. But before that, we have our normal conversation, Mike and I, about whose country is more fucked, the United States or the United Kingdom. Mike, over to you.
Well, you know, every week this is a rather banal debate, isn't it? Because I always say my country is more fucked. Although having said that, I'm now quite a ways through Luke's book, and I've done the chapter on Russian influence peddling in London, and it brought me back to those halcyon days of around 2010, where spies in the embassy were recruiting young Tories who just dreamed of getting big-breasted Russian girlfriends and Gazprom contracts. And then I got to the bit about Nigel Farage and Aaron Banks. And so, I might actually, on this occasion, John, I might give you a few extra points and say your country is just as fucked or nearly just as fucked as mine. But that we still have Donald Trump, who did not undergo any kind of Damascene conversion thanks to the plague. Not that Boris really did, but at least he came out sounding a bit cuddlier than he went in. And the only thing I can say on an optimistic note is that it really does seem like Trump is cooked. The poll numbers are not moving. Coronavirus here has now spiked again, thanks to the states that insisted upon reopening too early and too hazardously. And Biden, I think, according to, I don't know the metrics that go into polling, but according to everyone I read who seems to know what they're talking about, he's got the most comfortable and consistent lead of any nominee since this science began. So we shall see. There's all kinds of cultural complaint issues that are popping up in this country. You may have seen this whole notorious letter about the erosion of liberalism and freedom of speech. We don't get into that in this episode because we have too much more important stuff and two fabulous guests to weigh in on our other favorite topic.
Yes. Which is Russia.
Yeah.
By the way, I'm excited that Trump looks as though he's going to lose because, as our free listeners will know, I've got a £500 bet on Trump to be defeated by Joe Biden. And for the moment, my money is looking good, but one always worries. So anyway, remember, this is also, as well as an intellectual podcast, where we try and probe the influence of spies and lies on our great democracies. It's also a bit of a drinking game.
Not today it isn't. It's 10 a.m. here. I really have to be in a terrible state to start at this hour, my friend. So you kick them back for me. I'm on double espresso at the moment.
Okay, Catherine Belton, what are you drinking in London?
Diet Coke. It's the only thing that keeps me going.
There we go. Okay.
Disgrace. Luke Harding, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking a cup of British tea, which, given the gruesome events that have taken place in London, seems strangely appropriate.
This has become a gathering of Quakers, John. What have we done for this podcast?
Okay. Well, I for one, are keeping proper traditions going. I'm drinking limoncello.
You're going off, John.
It's homemade limoncello, which has come to me in a large plastic bottle with a blue screw tap. So it's conceivable that it could have been poisoned by the Russian secret state. I'm just going to have a sip now.
Are you aboard Roman Abramovich's yacht in Corfu just to set the scene a bit better?
No, I'm not in the. I'm in the heartland, the green heart of Italy. By the way, the limoncello is fantastic. It's not poisoned, and I'm still alive. So,
did it come from Lebedev's villa?
I've been there. I did a on Twitter. I did a film about Lebedev's villa, Boris, of course, went there. We were chatting about this before we came on, but there was this fantastic story by Jim Cusick for Open Democracy, in which he set out the evidence, all concerned deny any wrongdoing, that Boris had been to a number of parties at Lebedev's Palazzo, and he, at one of these occasions, a page-free girl, if I can describe her like that, took her top off and exposed herself, only to be removed because it wasn't quite the thing. And then, very shortly afterwards, The Guardian came up with a great story, a picture from a member of the public of Boris at Perugia Airport, looking incredibly hungover, the same kind of condition I'll look after when I finish this limoncello. But anyway, I did a little film on Twitter, and I got the wrong palazzo, because the Lebedevs got two palazzos in Umbria, and then I did a correction. But essentially, both palazzos are very, very beautiful, and they are very, very difficult to get at. So the mystery is, who is it a good idea for Boris Johnson to go to what people say are bunga bunga parties at Lebedev's Palazzo? Luke Harding, author of Shadow State, what do you think to that question?
Well, we still don't quite know what went on. Now, I mean, I know Alexander Lebedev pretty well. He was one of my best contacts in Moscow, and actually told me over lunch some years ago that he was about to buy the Evening Standard. And he's a former KGB officer without the former, insofar as you never really fully leave the Russian sort of security services. And what we've seen from Lebedev in recent years is that he, having been out of favor with the regime, he's got back into favor by banging the drum over Crimea and by hanging out with foreign ministry people. And he basically wants to play on both squares. He wants to be friends with the Kremlin, but he also wants to be friends with Boris Johnson, who keeps flying out for these kind of weird weekends to Italy, where you are. And I would like to know why Boris Johnson feels obliged to do that. I mean, that particular weekend, he left his Foreign Office security detail behind. And the timing was really odd, because it was just after Sergei Skripal got whacked with Novichok in Salisbury. So why would you then, as Foreign Secretary, fly out there now? I mean, there may be an innocent explanation, but the problem is with Boris Johnson, he also... after winning this historic general election victory last December, the first thing he did the next day was to go to Lebedev's senior 60th birthday party at this mansion in central London. Again, odd behaviour, all the while suppressing the Russia report. And I think the sort of substantial point is that the Conservative Party, to some degree, has been captured by Russian money. I know all people deny wrongdoing, et cetera, et cetera. But we see millions sloshing in there, and I find this wherever you stand politically, I find this very troubling.
The problem, of course, is that actually Jeremy Corbyn gave the benefit of the doubt after the Skripal attack, so that certainly now we haven't seen Keir Starmer put out his shop on foreign policy yet. But Corbyn actually voiced arguments much more sympathetic to the Kremlin than the Tories did on Skripal. But I take your point. Catherine, do you think it was wise of Boris Johnson to be so friendly with the Lebedevs?
Of course not. I think we're in a very unfortunate situation where institutions in the UK appear to have systematically undermined and bought up by Russian influence. And we all know sort of how predominant Russian cash seems to have been in sort of funding of the Vote Leave campaign. There are still many questions surrounding sort of the provenance of the funds that are Banks used to fund the Leave campaign. He has, of course, been cleared by the NCA of any kind of illicit activity in relation to that. The NCA has clearly stated that he received a loan from one of his Isle of Man companies to fund his £8 million donation to the Vote Leave campaign. But even though Mr. Banks has repeatedly stated he doesn't have any ties to Russia, we still don't know anything further beyond the Isle of Man company. And obviously, Isle of Man is a notoriously murky jurisdiction. The company that he received it from is also co-owned by one of Aaron Banks's close business partners, Jim Mellon, who has, in fact, been deeply invested in Russia over the years since the 90s. And despite his denials, his own corporate disclosures show that he had a significant stake in a big Russian investment fund right up till the end of 2016, i.e. after the referendum on Brexit. So I think we have all kinds of questions. And another big issue that we need to look at are hedge funds and their role in funding. So a lot of political activities here, and hedge funds are the most notoriously non-transparent institutions out there. We don't know whose clients are, who the clients are who are funding many of these activities. You know, once, and the problem is most of the Russian money, as Luke has reported very often, has come into the UK through money laundering schemes, into LLPs where you don't have to disclose beneficial ownership. In fact, you don't have to disclose anything. You can fake your company accounts because you don't even have to have business activity here. And once it's in the kind of the mill, it's just part of a slush fund and it becomes untraceable for anyone to penetrate. So I think, yeah, we've got a lot of work to do to try and figure out where all the cash is pouring into politicians' coffers. We have to trace where it's coming from.
I was saying,
remember, I just want to interrupt here, a little legal. All concerned deny any wrongdoing. Remember, I'm actually the only one on alcohol, and I keep on going to say that.
I was going to say, not to interrupt, but you know, I lived in the UK. I lived in London from about 2010 to 2012, and as I said before we started recording, you know, reading Luke's book had brought me back to that period, because, you know, I remember at the time, and this sort of was happening below the radar. I mean, Luke was reporting on it. I did a bit of reporting myself. You had the Russian embassy in Kensington Gardens doing enormous outreach to young Conservative Party members and Tories, really kind of up and coming, you know, guys on the make. But one of the guys doing this, a man called Sergei Nalobin, who his father was KGB. I think his father was at one time the boss of Alexander Litvinenko in the Economic Crimes Division of KGB. And I think, Luke, correct me if I'm wrong, his brother was also known to be an SVR officer somewhere in Latin America.
I think FSB, but yeah, also as
part FSB, of yeah. I mean, this guy had, you know, Czechist pedigree. And he was seen being photographed with Boris Johnson. I think he was photographed with Cameron at one point. He would hand out his business card at all these sort of swish Tory cocktail parties. And it seemed a very concerted effort at that time to get in bed with the party. And, you know, you'll recall, like, okay, Theresa May, she expelled, 35 Russian spies after Skripal. But I also remember during the Litvinenko inquest debate, should there even be an inquest or an inquiry, whatever it was called, she was dragging her feet. And a lot of members of the Conservative Party have had really strange relationships with Russian oligarchs, Russian money. I mean, I did a report at one point that the Queen's, the keeper of the privy purse, his son started a hedge fund in the UK with money that had come from Eugene Schwidler, who is known as Roman Abramovich's representative on Earth. And I had this report, and I went to somebody from what was then known as the Financial Services Authority, and I said, "Are you aware of this? I mean, this is, you know, someone close to the royal family." And the answer I got was, "Look, we're up against it from two sides. On the one hand, you've got the city, which doesn't want to do anything to disrupt the steady flow of rubles from Moscow to London. And there's enormous Russian investment in the UK, particularly the real estate market. And the other side, you've got Westminster and both parties, which don't really want to rock the boat with Russia because they don't want to wake up one day and, you know, here's another WMD attack on London streets." So this thing has been going on for quite a while, at least 10 years, as you know, by my reckoning. I mean, do you guys, I put this to both of you, have you seen that there's been an increase lately in this kind of outreach, perhaps as a result of Brexit, perhaps as a result of kind of the rise of the authoritarian populist right? Or is this all of a piece that, you know, this has been a long-term strategy of cultivating relationships with the Conservative Party?
I mean, I think it's been a continuum, and it's quite interesting. You mentioned Sergei Malobin, who hates me, but he was the one who founded this group, the Conservative Friends of Russia. He's also an FBR guy, allegedly. I would say he denied it, but when I last emailed him, he didn't respond. But let's say he denies it. But essentially, he's a kind of, we would think he was the kind of number two spy at the Russian embassy, and he was really successful. There was this notorious garden party where there were bottles of vodka as raffle prizes, biographies of Putin, John Whittingdale, the Conservative MP, was there. And someone called Carrie Simmons turned up as well. I wonder what happened to her. Matthew Elliott was also enjoying the garden party at the Russian ambassador's residence. And of course, he went on to kind of co-chair Vote Leave. And it was this nucleus of kind of hard right Eurosceptics that the Russian spies were cultivating. And once Nalobin had to leave, I think partly as a result of kind of, you know, our reporting, Mike, this other shady character called Alexander Udot took over. And I try and sort of sketch out his biography in Shadow State. But Udot was the liaison man with Levy Yu, with Aaron Banks, with Nigel Farage, and so on. And he was the one who basically brokered various meetings between Banks and the Russian ambassador in the same residence, which Banks, let's say, didn't tell the truth about for a couple of years. He said there was one, then it turned out there were multiple. And I think what we can say is that, as a minimum, the Kremlin had the inside track on the Brexit campaign. I mean, Udo was at the Farage's victory party in Milbank the night of the Brexit vote. So there was a spy and there was Farage. That they had the inside track, but also, as Catherine was saying, they were offering various special sweetheart deals, gold, diamonds, more gold to Banks and those around him. And just what I would say lastly is what I find so dispiriting is that Mike, at least, you have had Mueller. And I think Mueller was a deeply flawed exercise, but it was a kind of semi-sincere attempt by the US to interrogate what happened in 2016 with the Russians helping elect Donald Trump. We have none of that. We haven't seen the Russian report. Boris Johnson doesn't want to talk about it. Theresa May ran away from it. And it's actually been left to people like us, the four of us, I would say, plus, you know, Carol Cadwallader and a few others, to try and ask the difficult questions. And we still don't really have the answers.
That's all true. Obviously, all concerned deny any wrongdoing. And the Office of Gold and Diamonds and so forth, as far as we can tell, didn't come to anything, but it seems as though those offers were made.
I think that's not quite true either, but maybe we can move on.
Just on Aaron Banks, he had a go at me the other day on Twitter, and he said, "You're as slippery as a snake on a stripper's pole." And I replied, "Mr. Banks, you seem to be confusing me with your wife, Katya Pagarina, who, according to The New Yorker, was deported from Dubai for being a common prostitute." And Mr. Banks fell silent. I just put it out there, but I think everybody should know that Katya Banks was born in Russia, is the daughter of a government official in Yekaterinburg, and she's a feisty lady. She married a merchant seaman who was twice her age in Portsmouth. They ended up, the Banks, owning a company called Ural Properties, and I dug into it when I was at Newsnight, and we found that this property owned two flats overlooking the Royal Naval Dockyard at Portsmouth. Now, obviously, none of that suspicious, or concerned about any wrongdoing. Catherine, I want to ask you, the thing that I found most chilling about your book was the moment I read that what Putin was doing in Dresden, in Stasiland, in East Germany, before the fall of the wall, was he was running far-left terrorist operations in West Berlin, and they would come to Dresden for support, for money, and he would run them. one of the sources for that story is still being protected by German security, by the German equivalent of MI5. That's right, yeah?
It's not quite correct. There was a source who was a Stasi agent who later defected into the West, who'd worked very closely with Putin in Dresden. And he had previously told of how Putin was, in fact, a handler for a notorious neo-Nazi called Rainer Sonntag, who'd then kind of emigrated into the West and returned to Dresden, where he really did stoke the rise of the far right there. And this was a Stasi agent who really was privy to a lot of the details of what Putin was up to. He's also told of how Putin tried to acquire an untraceable poisonous material. We haven't heard that before ever, of course. And that he tried to acquire this from a professor, and he was trying to do so by planting pornographic material on him. We don't know whether this operation ever got off the ground, but it certainly sounds like familiar tactics. So that is the source who, unfortunately, I was trying to reach out to him to corroborate another source's story, this source who had indeed been a former member of the Red Army faction, but I was told quite resoundingly that I would not be able to reach this former Stasi operative because he was now under protection. So I presume he knows an awful lot more. But the former Red Army faction member had a very compelling and credible story to tell. So even though it wasn't possible to verify it, I tried to check with other Stasi officers who worked with Putin, and they sort of, their faces just clouded over and they went silent if I asked about it. I also asked a former close KGB allies of Putin's about whether Putin was working with the Red Army faction in Dresden, and he almost spat at me and said, this has never been proven that the KGB ever worked with terrorist groups and you should not try to. So I didn't get very far in verifying it, but it was certainly something that I discussed with my editor, and we believe that it was compelling and credible enough to tell this story of the former Red Army faction member who said that he would travel from into East Berlin on the train. He would from there get picked up in a Zill old Soviet car, and they'd sort of rattle down the roads to Dresden, where they'd meet in a safe house with KGB officers and Stasi officers. And among them, supposedly, was Vladimir Putin, who he said was often taking the lead. They weren't giving orders to the members of the Red Army faction, but they were certainly making suggestions and helping them acquire weapons and cash. He said they'd hand over a list of what they needed in West Germany, and then the KGB and Stasi officers present would arrange through their networks in the West for them to be given whatever they needed in sort of various safe houses in West Germany. So, it was certainly a compelling story, and it certainly rings true for how we see Putin and his men, unfortunately, operating today. It's the same type of toolkit. It was the same then in the late 80s as it is now. Now Russia isn't able to compete directly economically or militarily with the West, but it can actually do a very good job in active measures, sort of either planting disinformation or fake rumors or supporting front organizations which are sort of sowing chaos in the West. So I'm afraid we just see them resorting to the same tactics that they knew very well then.
It's interesting. There was an operation, I think, in the mid-50s, the KGB planned from East Germany, which was to recruit agents, some of them essentially neo-Nazis, send them into West Germany and have them mark up Jewish gravestones with swastikas, synagogues, and all the rest of it. And then use that, of course, as the pretense to claim that Nazism is again on the rise in West Germany. It really is extraordinary that, all of the things that we've read about, whether it be in the Mueller report or investigative reporting in the last 10 or so years, there really is nothing new under the sun. This is what the special services are past masters at doing, stoking these kinds of ethnic racial tensions, creating a kind of inferno in the West and then saying, oh, look at them, their house is burning down.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate that they're not more skilled at kind of developing their own economy. And in fact, their skills only lie in black operations. I mean, the whole world is suffering from that.
Yeah.
But it feels like that what Vladimir Putin was trying to do for the KGB in the 80s was to run infiltration agents against the West. And that's what he's continuing to do now that he's master of the Kremlin.
Yes, I think it's been a process, but I think that he's had a kind of a long disappointment with the West. I think perhaps he came to power in the early 2000s believing he might be able to do a deal with George Bush. I think he wanted the West to respect Russia's sphere of interest, that the West wouldn't expand any nearer eastwards towards Russia's borders. And he did make overtures to the US president early on in 2001. We saw Russia opened Central Asia as a transit corridor for US troops and military supplies for Afghanistan. So, I mean, he did make overtures, but he didn't sort of get anything that he wanted in return. So it kind of made it much easier for the security men surrounding him to sort of prod him into this more and more aggressive stance, which we saw really reach its zenith in 2007 when Putin lectured the West at the Munich Security Conference about the rise of China, India, and Russia, and he was railing against how the West was ignoring Russia's interests through kind of building the missile defense shield in Romania and Poland and allowing the march of NATO eastwards. And really, he kind of laid down the gauntlet then. But I think the West just wasn't ready or willing to hear it. I think the West is too used to thinking of Russia as a weak basket case, which to some end it is, but it doesn't mean to say they can't wield an enormous amount of cash and use it to undermine institutions in the West, as we've seen. So I think it's been a gradual process of frustration on the Russian side, I think, and they've hit back.
On that point, I have a question.
We're all pulling in here.
Sorry, I just wanted to segue from that because, you know, one of the cliches you hear, particularly in Washington, even to this day, is, well, let's not inflate Putin's sort of cunning and his geopolitical genius. He's a lousy strategist, but he's an excellent tactician. And I wonder, I mean, is this a cliche that's worth kind of retiring? I mean, you know, Luke, you make the case in your book that Russia certainly interfered in the Brexit referendum. Whether or not it was a decisive interference, we don't know. I mean, it's still debatable in this country. We have no idea the impact of the GRU and the troll farms active measures in swaying the 2016 U.S. election. We may never know the answer to that. But if it were ever to be established that the Russian security services, with Putin sort of guiding them, instructing them, were successful in orchestrating or in determining the outcomes of those two sort of historically significant votes, I would say that goes well beyond tactics. That is strategic victory. Would you both agree?
I mean, I agree with that, and I sort of think it's interesting when you consider Putin conceptually. And the first thing that comes to mind is of this sort of supervillain, maybe wearing a kind of small, tight-fitting black leather jacket on a chair with a cap and flashing buttons and consoles and basically flipping switches and executing, you know, things in Chicago or Surrey or Umbria or whatever. I mean, clearly that's not how it works. I mean, he's a kind of classic kind of KGB opportunist, and I think there's a demonstrative element to these operations, and there's also a so what element. In other words, if you look at the Skripal misadventure, Skripal survived, and on one level it was kind of rather humiliating because these two idiot spies were caught on CCTV and they made this disastrous appearance on Russia Today and everyone laughed at them. But actually the message was sent, which was a message to the Brits that we hate you and we consider you to be kind of weak and vulnerable, but also a message to Russians, especially those working in spy agencies, that if they were to betray the motherland, then a kind of terrible fate would await them kind of around the corner. So I actually think that Putin has gone beyond what his kind of KGB KGB predecessors dreamt of. I mean, if you look at it from a sort of geostrategic point of view, he's succeeded. Let's say he co-contributed to the election of Donald Trump. Well, with Trump, we've seen the estrangement of the US from the European Union, from transatlantic partners, from Germany, France, UK, and so on. I mean, Trump has been the greatest asset, if you can call him that, for the Russians ever. And on Brexit, I think what Putin does is, if it's a 50-50 scenario, he pushes very hard in one direction. It's clear that Brexit is a preferred Russian foreign policy outcome because it weakens the UK. And one of the things I sort of picked up in my book, which is in the chapter, Mike, I think you've just read, called Moscow Gold, is just a really compelling clue that last summer, Alexander Yakovenko, the Russian ambassador in the UK, who'd been there for 8 years, was kind of recalled gloriously, given the order of Nevsky. And someone I talked to who knows Yakovenko pretty well quoted Yakovenko as saying, as he was about to kind of fly back to Moscow, we have crushed the British to the ground. They are on their knees and they will not rise for a very long time. And whether you believe it or not, there's no doubt that senior people inside Russia, inside the Russian machine, the bureaucratic machine, are taking credit for both Trump and Brexit. These are seen as espionage tramps that will be taught in SVR, FSB, GRU school for a long time to come.
A quick question. Do you think, Luke and Catherine, Christopher Steele is right when he says in his infamous, famous dossier that the Russians have compromised on Donald Trump? Do you think that judgment's right?
John, are you drinking limoncello and currently in Italy? I mean, sorry to jump in, Catherine, but all I would say is, look, you know, I'm a kind of lowly, unwashed Guardian journalist. And when I was in Moscow for almost 4 years, we had bugs in our apartments. We had regular break-ins from the FSB. We were advised by the British Embassy in Moscow that this was Putin's security goons and that they probably had video in our bedroom as well. And on one occasion, they left a sex manual by the bed after my wife and our small kids had gone on holiday to Berlin, and we found this thing bookmarked to a painting on orgasms, and I had to explain to my wife it was not my book. You know, it had been introduced by the case. Which doesn't sound very plausible, but it's true, John, Mike, Catherine, it's true. But the serious point is that if they would bother to do this to someone who's writing kind of mildly annoying stories for a newspaper in England that most Russians won't read, of course their technical guys will have full high-quality video from the presidential suite of the Ritz-Carlton, whether it's Obama staying there or Trump staying there or whatever. And we know that Trump has been on the radar of the KGB since his first trip to Moscow in 1987. They will have a huge compromat warehouse. They will have it'll be bigger than your palazzo, John. And they will have readouts from what he said back in 1987 and subsequently. They'll have multiple tapes. There won't be one Donald Trump tape. There'll be many. And it's not that they knew back in 1987 he was going to become president. It's just that he was someone that they assessed to be narcissistic, compromisable, prone to having affairs. And as ever, they kind of played a long game, and it came off on this occasion. So, I mean, there'll be a ton of stuff, but I would just say, lastly, I don't think Vladimir Putin, when he meets Donald Trump for these private, no note-taker, no-one-listening-in meetings, I don't think he says, Donald, do what I say or we release the tape. I think he just flatters him in classic KGB style and says, Donald, you are a wonderful leader beset by opprobrious and evil liberals, and I will be with you. I will be your friend. I will be your rock. We revere you in Russia. And this kind of gloopish sycophancy, it works.
That's all it would take with Donald Trump. I mean, the North Koreans probably aren't nearly as sophisticated as case officers, but I mean, look at the love affair with Trump and Kim, based on one chance, quite staged encounter, which has yielded no diplomatic or military results. No, the man is consummately flatterable. That's not a word, but I've just invented it. I mean, you know, what you have to do is cater to his ego. And, you know, it's funny because I spoke to a former CIA officer called Burton Gerber, who's kind of a legend in the agency. He was in charge of Rick Ames when Ames started working for the KGB, and is seen as a sort of, you know, the kind of quintessential counterintelligence mind from the Cold War. And I asked him, I said, look, you know, if put yourself in the position of the KGB in the 1980s, is Donald Trump the kind of person you recruit as an agent? And he said, no, you don't recruit someone as an agent if they have the kind of temperament and personality traits of Donald Trump. He's too flamboyant. He's too much of a loudmouth. He's too, as Luke says, narcissistic, megalomaniacal. He's unpredictable. And the worst thing you can do is have an unpredictable agent. But what you do is you turn him into an agent of influence. Or I guess there's another term of art, Luke, you mentioned in your book, where you feed him things. You push him in the direction he's already inclined to go. You just push him that extra step further. You reaffirm his worldview at every opportunity. I think that is a fairly uncontroversial way of assessing the kind of relationship that Trump has had with the Kremlin going back many decades now, whoever's in charge.
I want to, one thing about the relationship between Putin and Trump, it is noticeable. It's that nothing is on the record. He tries to have his communications with Putin as private as possible. And this is out of completely out of the run of how to do it. You've got to have people there who know what's going on. Everything's taped from the American side, not with Trump. And it's a peculiar relationship. But I'm sorry, I'm going to bring in Scientology here. I'm sorry about this. But I've spoken to ex-members of the Church of Scientology who were audiovisual people who listened in and monitored for audio and visual purposes Tom Cruise and John Travolta talking about their intimate sexual details as part of Scientology's confession. They call it auditing. Now, Cruise and Travolta deny that, said the Church of Scientology, they say I'm a bigot, a liar, etc. However, the ex-Scientologist said this happened. And so what you've got is a situation of passive blackmail where everybody, the marks, know that everything embarrassing or shaming in their lives that the this organization has. So the organization doesn't have to say, doesn't have to spell it out. And I think that's the relationship, I fear that's the relationship between Putin and Trump. Putin doesn't have to say, we know what you got up to in the fancy hotel with the prostitute show, because they both know that. And it's just there in the background, but nevertheless, it could be a driver. But Catherine.
Yeah, I actually wanted to talk about that because we don't remember Emin Agalarov before Trump set off for Helsinki to meet for Putin, meet with Putin. He actually did a very good job in trolling Trump precisely over that. Everyone should remember the music video that he released of Trump meeting prostitutes in a hotel room in Moscow, and the song was called "You Really Got Me Good." I mean, what more do you want? And after that, we all saw
Sorry, Catherine. Sorry to interrupt. Explain what happened to our list to our three listeners.
Ah, okay. So before Trump set off for Helsinki, Emin Agalarov, who is the son of Aras Agalarov, who organized the infamous Miss Universe contest in Moscow in 2013 when Trump was supposedly, allegedly compromised, he released a music video. He's a popular singer in Azerbaijan and trying to make it big in the West, but he did so very deliberately, it seems, shortly before Trump's departure for this major summit. All over YouTube and everywhere else, he had a very quite not graphic, but it was very clear what was going on, a video of Trump meeting with prostitutes in a swanky hotel room, and the song was called "You Really Got Me Good." I mean, it seemed like a very kind of a clear example of what you were just talking about, John, where sort of the Russians are sort of rubbing their hands and and demonstrating, not even subliminally, but quite clearly, that they sort of have got some kind of hold over the US president. I mean, maybe they were just joking, maybe it was an inside joke, but it certainly looked like Trump was acting very obsequiously when he arrived.
But that's, Catherine, isn't that the trick, right? I mean, they can pass this off as they're just taking the piss, that it's just a joke. They're mocking the news coverage of all this Russiagate conspiracy stuff. But in fact, we don't know if it's a joke. They know if it's a joke or if they're actually being serious and they're firing a shot across Trump's bow, right? That's the genius of these sort of little active measures, maneuvers, whatever you want to call them. And you know, to this extent, actually, I want to ask you both, because you both cover the security services for a living in your book and you've reported on them. In the Cold War, the KGB seemed to be much more of a gray, dour apparatus. Today, you have this sort of postmodern aspect to intelligence work from the Russian side, where there's sort of a wink and a nudge factor. I mean, Luke, you mentioned the Mishkin Chapiga interview on RT, which, I mean, even Margot Simonyan was sort of rolling her eyes at how embarrassing it was. And that simply would be unimaginable, right? In like 1973, two GRU assassins get caught, and then they suddenly go on Soviet state television and say, "We're not from the GRU; we're homoerotic sports nutritionists." Right? I mean, it's just, explain to me from your perspective, both of you, the element of humor, the sort of satirical quality that Putin's services now plies their trade with.
Yeah, I mean, I for one found that story about being homoerotic sports nutritionist in Switzerland. I find it quite convincing, Mike. I don't know where your American skepticism comes from. I take your point. I think with Chapiga and Mishkin, they were trying the Andrei Lugovoy model. Lugovoy being the assassin who poisoned Alexander Litvinenko, or co-poisoned him with a radioactive cup of tea. And Lugovoy is quite a fluent TV performer. I mean, you look at his eyes and they're completely chillingly dead, but he lies in a kind of plausible way. Whereas these two people were kind of wombles by comparison. They were just bungling amateur. It was amateur hour. And I think it's interesting that we haven't seen them again. But what there is for sure is an element of trolling. I mean, I think, you know, I've written a book called Mafia State about Russia and Shadow State, but also Troll State. It's the foremost exponent of trolling. I mean, literally, in that there are dozens or perhaps hundreds of disaffected, cynical 20, 30-somethings sitting in a St. Petersburg warehouse, tapping away so that whenever John Sweeney tweets another untruth, that immediately he's kind of attacked by this sort of bot army who rightly point out inconsistencies in his story, etc., etc. So there's that kind of trolling. But also, if you look at the account of the Russian embassy in London, it's also become a form of trolling. I mean, they don't really do conventional diplomacy anymore. They do this kind of winky, winky, sarcastic, postmodern kind of attack dog stuff. I don't know if it works or not, but it seems kind of crazy for an important country of 145 million people that they have these kind of diplomat jokers. I mean, just think of the press conferences that Yakovenko gave after Skripal was poisoned, where he started talking about Billenkat all the time, Billenkat being, and the Skripals being kidnapped by the British and hidden in a cave. I mean, it's trying to kind of nonsense the hell out of the world.
Yeah. I'm afraid, yeah, Luke is right, but I'm afraid it's also, I think they have a almost a sense of superiority now. I think most of the kind of ex-KGB or current and former sort of security service people I've spoken to, they kind of look on the West with a slight disdain. They see the West as having become complacent, lazy and arrogant, that it's sort of still basking in this post-Cold War victory and sort of has dropped its hands. They think that all the sort of London bankers are interested in getting home to the pub in time and buying themselves a third house. And one former KGB officer was sort of talking disdainfully to me about how the youth of the West, they only spent their time in cafes and they weren't motivated to do anything. And there's a real kind of chip on your shoulder, kind of driving kind of motivation there. They a lot of the sort of Russian security service type people that I've spoken to, they're obviously very, very educated, and they do kind of just really kind of look down on the West and think that the West has just sort of dropped its hands and has believed that it's all kind of powerful. And I think to some degree they are right, because we've seen this in the way that the West has sort of opened its doors to Russian money without really wondering about the consequences. Yeah. And we see this too in what Mike was talking about how the West kind of likes to sort of brush aside Putin as just this sort of tactician who's not really going to be successful at anything. I mean, they're partly right, because I think it's a long-term strategy. Trying to undermine and disrupt other countries isn't going to work in the long term. If your own economy is not powerful and strong, you can do a bloody good job sort of causing chaos in other countries for quite some time, but it's not going to help you if at some point your own population is losing their jobs and eventually rising against you. But I think, you know, I think the West has had a superiority complex too, that's basically meant that it hasn't examined closely enough some of the threats of Putin's rule.
No, that's certainly true. By the way, Catherine, I was going to challenge you on something earlier. In my introduction to Putin was that I went undercover to Chechnya in 2000 twice. And on the way, I went to Ryazan and I checked out the story behind the 99 apartment bombs in Moscow. And essentially, the Ryazan is a provincial town, 2 or 3 hours drive from Moscow, south of it. And there was another bomb which was discovered there. Essentially, about 200 or so, 300 Russians were killed in a couple of bombs in September 99, and instantly Putin, the new prime minister, blamed the Chechens and said, "We're going to, in very, very crude Russian, we're going to hunt them down, we're going to flush them in the shitter, the outhouse, the outside loo." And suddenly nobody knew who he was. It's like 2% popularity rating. So then he went through the roof, because he was a tough guy who was going to do something. And that there is strong and compelling evidence that this was a black operation by the KGB, FSB, and they blew up, Russians. That somebody's phone, switch it off, never mind. Then there was Chechnya, and the second Chechen war was brutal and ugly, and I saw evidence of war crimes there. So I think that the idea that Putin would say the West didn't play nicely with the Russians, with me, is wrong, because he was, I have to say this, he was a force for darkness from the get-go.
Yes, that's true to some degree, but that doesn't mean that he didn't feel sort of entitled in some way that the West should treat them nicely. I'm afraid that the security men came to power, they wanted, or they believed that they were restoring stability to Russia. They believed that they were preventing what they saw as impending collapse under Russia, under Yeltsin. Of course, this is to some degree their own myth-making, but I think they just believed that they were entitled to a seat at the table, and it's a kind of a sense of entitlement that stems from all of the Soviet sacrifices in the World War II, and we've seen Putin refer to that time and again. And I think, you know, it's kind of President Obama once referred to Putin as like the bored kid at the back of the classroom, but I'm afraid he graduated from that sort of sense of insolence from being the bored kid to the guy kind of pulling faces and causing havoc at the back of the classroom when he was ignored. But yeah, I agree with you. Of course, there were atrocious things happening in Chechnya, and the West did then call him out on it, far more so than they do now over what the Russians are doing in Syria, for instance. It's quite astonishing how kind of inured we've become to these tactics.
I don't think we didn't really, the West gave Putin the benefit of the doubt over the Moscow apartment bombs and over what happened in Chechnya, because they didn't want to fall out with him. Mm. And that's been the way for, I think, too long. But another thing is, when I go to Russia, I get followed all the time. I interview supporters of Navalny himself. Navalny's been half blinded temporarily because somebody threw some gunk in his face and there was something bad in it. His supporters get beaten up, tasered, stabbed, all this stuff. Russia is not a democracy. And there is, and part of the frustration of telling the story here is that this isn't, you know, two separate democracies, or three, the United States, Britain, Russia. Russia is not a democracy. It doesn't play by the rules. Do you see Putin falling from power soon, or do you think he's there for a long time? Luke, first of all.
Well, I think he's there for forever. I mean, forever and ever and ever, and then a bit longer. I mean, I just had a quick point about what you were saying about this sort of chapter of misunderstanding between Russia and the West. Certainly the West shoulders some of the blame, but I also think it's Putin and the people around him mirror thinking that actually the UK, the US are just as corrupt and nihilistic as Russia is. And just one example I think is kind of quite striking is that the estrangement between London and Moscow happened in the noughties after Putin flew in to meet with the Queen and Tony Blair. And about 2 years later, picked up the phone to Blair and said, look, can you send back this guy called Boris Berezovsky, a sort of renegade oligarch? And Blair said, well, look, our judicial system is independent. You know, I can't just phone up the judge and tell him what to do. And Putin didn't believe him. Putin thought that he was being humiliated by Blair and just couldn't conceive that British courts could be the real deal. But just on your question about staying forever, yeah, I mean, it's a personist system. I think it's now, it's always been a sort of soft dictatorship, but it's now clear that's what it is. I think the constitutional pretense that something else has gone. And Putin will stay forever because of the logic of his situation. He knows that were he to meaningfully step down to a real successor, that his options would be prison or the other option. And you can guess what the other option is. And so he has to stay there forever. And I mean, again, it sounds bonkers, but I'm sure their interest in science and nanotechnology is that these overweight mid-60-something kind of KGB officers want to live forever. If they could spend their billions in eternal life, they would. So you and I, John, will be old men by the time Putin leaves office, or we may even predecease him. I mean, it's Trump will be gone, the virus will be gone, your podcast will be gone, Boris Johnson will be gone, and Putin will still be there.
Catherine, what do you think?
Yeah, I think he's hostage to the situation he created himself. I think probably he wants to step down from a personal point of view. I mean, it must be exhausting ruling a country like that for 20 years. But there's no way out for him, even if he wanted to step down. I think the security men have convinced him on several occasions that he can't and he shouldn't. I've been told there's been sort of numerous times when he's wanted to step down and he's been told not to. I mean, it's possible he could use these constitutional changes allowing him to stay in power till 2036. It's possible that he could be using it as a tool that he can use this to buy time, to find some kind of a viable successor type who would be malleable and just basically listen to his orders, who he and his security men could control while Putin played the dear leader of the nation and sort of whiled away his times in a palace, in his swimming pool, as he likes to do. But it's very, very risky, so they have to get it right, so which is why they can't afford to have the time, kind of the clock openly ticking on this, because any false move and that's it. Yeah, it's jail, or as Luke put it, the other option.
So We're running out of time, but do you think the British media, the British broadcasters, give a true flavour of what it's like to be in Moscow, to live in Moscow?
Well, I mean, yeah, John, that's a tricky question. And obviously you have something to say on this. I was kicked out of Moscow in 2011. And I'm not suggesting that other sort of correspondents should kind of follow that path. And it was pretty unpleasant. It was never something I kind of wish for. I mean, I think what I would say is that there are certain topics that the Kremlin doesn't want you to investigate. And I would just salute Catherine. I mean, she's written a stupendously good book which anatomizes this kleptocracy, and she's been kind of fantastically brave. But you know, there is a kind of price to pay, and whether that price is you don't get a visa anymore, or you get put in an airport cell like I do, or whatever, you know, the financial flows are taboo, the espionage is taboo. It is quite hard to be a reporter in Moscow, and so I wouldn't sort of criticize anyone who's there. But I do think that at the end of the day, you have to tell the truth about this regime. It's a particularly nasty, thuggish, crude regime. It's not the only one, but it's sinister. It's globally ambitious. It's revisionist. It's good at lying. It's got mass propaganda outlets, and it has a tribe of useful idiots in the West, both in America and the UK, who tend to believe it. So I think it's quite dangerous, and I think it's our job to expose it.
Yeah. I think Luke has done a tremendous job in doing precisely that, and that's obviously why he faced so many troubles while he was out there. I was much lower profile than Luke, so I got away with keeping a very low profile. But I think the Russian regime is also quite good at cultivating some of the Western correspondents. You can live quite a nice life in Moscow. You can get driven around everywhere. Where it's quite an easy lifestyle. So I think, you know, to some degree, there is some cultivation going on, but it's quite frankly not very successful. So I think, yeah, it depends.
Yeah, I feel I just so the last time BBC long form had a real go at the Russian state with the Panorama I did in 2018, and there hasn't been one since. And I feel, oh, come on, chaps, you know, we've got to do better than this, because you can see the power, you can see the money, you can see the influence boards. It kind of reminds me of the 30s of Walter Duranty, and you've written your books. I've written my novel, The Useful Idiot, about Gareth Jones. But there's this awful sense that this is history repeating itself, that Western journalists, with the exception of Gareth Jones and Malcolm Muggeridge and one American Trotskyist, they didn't tell the truth about Stalin's famine, in which millions died. And I don't think the Western publics are, despite all our best efforts, properly understand the extent to which the master of the Kremlin is kind of the master of all he surveys at the moment.
I think the Western correspondents do a very good job who are out there. I know that it's very easy to sort of get locked in your Moscow bubble, where obviously you're trying to get interviews, you're trying to get access, and you're busy chasing a fast moving day to day story. So sometimes you can lose sight of the bigger picture. But obviously it's not the same as the Walter Duranty situation. There aren't sort of millions dying or anything like that. But I do know, for instance, like Reuters, where I'm working now, they've done sort of very strong reports on the activities of the Wagner mercenaries in Libya and Syria. And yes, they have faced a great deal of pressure as a result. I'm not going to go into what exactly, but, you know, these are the things that they have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. So it is very, very tough now being a correspondent there.
I would agree with that. It's a tough gig, and I salute the people who are there. And most of all, actually, I have to say I salute the Russian journalists who are out there and who are kind of exposing abuses, because ultimately they are far more vulnerable than the foreigners, and they do some great reporting.
Smashing. Okay, so you've been listening to the Last Call with John Sweeney and Michael Weiss, and our great guests today have been Luke Harding, the author of The Shadow State, and Catherine Belton, Putin's People. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.